In her new book, the science journalist Sarah Everts tells this weird story. It's the summer of 1996, and a woman walks into a hospital in Cape Town, South Africa with, like I said, this weird problem.
She's a nurse, and she starts to notice this very alarming thing on her clothing. Her sweat has turned red. Where her armpits are, along her collar, there is just like this pinkish red color every time she sweats. Not only is this really abnormal for a body and kind of alarming in that way, but, you know, her job is to, you know, appear hygienic and, well, hopefully to be hygienic too. And so she's worried also about like the professional consequences of having red sweat. So she goes to the dermatologist. And whereas she's completely freaked out, they are completely fascinated because red sweat. And so they take her on as a patient and try and figure out what the heck is going on. Initially, they are utterly stumped. She has no kind of pre-existing conditions. She's a woman in her 20s, perfect health, you know, red sweat notwithstanding. So they kind of send her away. They do a bunch of tests. And finally, at a follow-up appointment, she shows up with kind of these funny red stains on her fingers. Like if you know somebody who rolls their own cigarettes, the color of nicotine. So they say to her, "What's on your fingers?" And she's like, "Oh, I just had, you know, my favorite snack." And they're like, "Oh, what kind of snack was that?" And it turns out she loved a certain kind of corn chip called spicy tomato. It was made by a company called Knick Knacks. She was having multiple, like 45 bags of chips a week. And effectively, they figured out that she was eating so much of these chips that her body was accumulating the red flavoring and coloring in her bloodstream, and it was circulating around in her blood. And since sweat is sourced from the watery parts of blood, that coloring was coming out in her sweat. They put her on an elimination diet, and once she stopped eating these chips, her sweat went right back to normal.
What do you think this tells us about sweat and the way it works, this story?
Our sweat is really good at sharing our secrets, right? There's a way in which we are mortified by our sweat because of the fact that it's dank patches under your armpits, or sweaty hands means you're a little bit nervous. Or, you know, some of us are mortified by the body odor we produce. But, you know, even on a deeper level, our sweat shares even the secrets of our vices. You know, anything that's floating around in your blood that's small can come out. So I, for example, had my sweat tested, and the forensic chemist who analyzed my sweat was like, "You had a morning coffee today, Sarah." Not terribly embarrassing as a vice, but had I spiked that coffee with a bit of vodka or some other form of intoxicant on the side, that would have also come out in my sweat. And so, yeah, your sweat reveals so much about you, whether you like it or not. It's kind of a very honest signal that we produce.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Before Sarah Everts heard about the nurse in South Africa, she was like most of us who figure sweat is just salt and water that covers our naked, mostly hairless human bodies and cools us down. But she says, to know that our bodies also leak these secrets about us, she said, that was way more interesting because just how does sweat work anyway? Why is it a uniquely human feature? And what else could sweat tell us about ourselves? Everts titled her book, The Joy of Sweat, which tells you something about how much she loves this subject. She calls our ability to sweat curiously dramatic.
It's so flamboyant to have millions of sweat glands on your body suddenly open up and have floods of liquid pour out onto your skin. I mean, we're kind of used to it, despite being mortified by it. We're used to this, but it's such a breach of our body, right? You know, so much is just suddenly coming out. So I find it a really fascinating way to cool down, but it's also, you know, incredibly human because, you know, most other animals aren't, you know, naked, right? We have this huge real estate of our body off of which we can evaporate water to cool us down, right? So we have this like platform for cooling that most other animals don't have. If you think of a dog, its mostly naked spot is its tongue. And so, just on that small real estate of its tongue, it's heaving and panting to evaporate off the water from saliva to cool down its whole body. Whereas we have our whole body to cool down our inside. So it's super efficient, but it's also, I mean, it's arguably as much as, you know, I wrote a book called The Joy of Sweat, and I love sweat. It is a kind of a weird thing. And, you know, many people throughout history have kind of looked at their bodies as this happened and gone, what the heck is going on?
Well, we'll dig into this in a moment here, but you describe the book as more than anything else, you say it's a perspiration pep talk. And this idea of how we think about our own sweat, how we've stigmatized sweating and odor, is an important part of the story. Explain what you mean, pep talk.
Well, you know, the reason I think we need a pep talk about it is honestly, it could have been so much worse. When you know how other animals are, you know, dispatching other bodily fluids for the purposes of cooling, it makes sweat look like glorious in comparison. So, for example, when a seal is trying to protect its real estate on a rock, doesn't want to leave it because it affects its mating luck. So it is hot, it's on a rock, it can't cool down in the ocean. So it pees on itself in order to cover its body with liquid off of which it, you know, evaporates away that heat. Vultures will poop on their own legs, this liquidy poop. Honeybees vomit on themselves to get their bodies wet enough to evaporate away heat. And, you know, a lot of animals use saliva in all sorts of ways. So, you know, compared to that, you know, the fact that humans rely on just a salty liquid is so much better in comparison to what evolution could have bequeathed us.
You mentioned that sweat is, of course, way more complicated than just salt and water. Sweat, you say, is chemically similar to blood, minus the red blood cells and the platelets. What is sweat?
Well, it really is just that watery part of blood. Your sweat glands try to scavenge a little bit of salt because, quite honestly, the reason our sweat is salty is because, you know, we are salty oceans inside. But for that cooling process, all we really need to dispatch onto skin is water, right? But we have a lot of water in our body. It's swirling around our circulatory system. It's, you know, keeping our organs moist. And so our body just recruits that liquidy parts of blood, or it's called interstitial fluid. Once it leaves, you know, the circulatory system and is, you know, you get the big stuff out and it's just kind of like a salty liquid. But literally everything in our bodies is circulating around and can come out in sweat. So, for example, you know, glucose, which is our body's energy molecule, comes out in sweat. Vitamins, hormones. So if you're stressed out, that can be detected in your sweat. So there's all sorts of ways to analyze that stuff that's swirling around in your body.
I like this tidbit from the book that if you gathered all the, you know, nearly 8 billion people on the planet, put them in a big, massive hot sauna, we would produce sweat on the volume of the Niagara Falls.
Yeah, yes, we would. That was really fun to figure out. I mean, we do produce like a lot of sweat, humans do, and all the time too, right? We notice it when,
Are
you
we
know, our
always
bodies
sweating?
get hot. Oh yeah, we're totally always sweating. Our body's constantly making very tiny micro adjustments, but you know, you only notice it when your body temperature really spikes. If your body just needs to make a micro adjustment, lets out just a very tiny amount that then evaporates away, and it doesn't collect on your skin. It collects on your skin when your body's probably in a little bit of a code red when it's thinking, oh gosh, our temperature inside is really going up, maybe because you're exercising or maybe because it's extremely hot outside. And so that's when your body really starts to pump out the sweat because it's, you know, really wants to make sure, maybe even overcompensate so that you don't die of heat stroke, because your body really can't go too high without, you know, kind of internal breakdown happening.
So when your body is dripping sweat, it means the body is being inefficient and sweat is trying to regulate that, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Your body kind of makes this Faustian decision. Like it thinks, you know, better to be wasteful with water, because then all you have to do is, you know, drink up after, than to risk heat stroke.
Sarah, help us understand, like, it's really interesting that, so humans are primates, but talk about the difference between humans and non-human primates in terms of the way we sweat. I mean, one of the things you mention in the book is that one of the reasons we lost body fur in favor of hair was to capitalize on this sweating mechanism. So talk a little bit about, when did we begin to evolve sweat glands, and how does it work for other primates, other non-human primates?
It's really interesting because evolution is very efficient, right? It likes to build upon itself. And so, you know, if you go back in our evolutionary history, all mammals actually have eccrine sweat glands, the kind of salty sweat gland, on their paws. But they only used that sweat for grip. And so you can imagine, you know, in you know, our evolutionary history, you know, when you need to run away from a predator, perhaps climb a tree, you want to have a tiny bit of grip on your paws so that you can get away fast and not slip. And so pretty much all mammals have what, you know, we consider sweat glands just on their paws, but they are not using it for temperature control. They're using it for grip. And then somehow throughout primate evolution, around the, you know, past the split between old world monkeys and new world monkeys, those eccrine sweat glands, the ones that produce the salty fluid, went and migrated over the whole body of these primates. But even if you look at chimpanzees, which are our closest evolutionary cousin, the chimp, although it has these sweat glands over its whole body, it primarily cools down by panting, kind of like a dog, because, as you point out, it's so hairy.
Yeah.
And so, you know, evolutionary biologists are really, really interested in figuring out, you know, what triggered this loss of hair and also an increase in density of sweat glands. Because, you know, when you do the kind of body size volume comparison to chimps, humans have about 10 times more sweat glands per, you know, unit area, surface area of our skin than chimps do. So, you know, we're losing hair and we're gaining sweat glands. And, you know, that's a bit of a chicken and an egg question, but, you know, there's really amazing evolutionary geneticists who are looking into this, mostly because, you know, sweat glands don't fossilize.
Yeah.
So most of the stuff that we need to learn about in terms of sweat evolution is done by analyzing ancient DNA from us, from chimps, and then going back into our primate lineage.
There's you talked to the evolutionary biologist, Daniel Lieberman, who mentioned that without sweating, we wouldn't have been able to become hunter-gatherers. It helped us dominate the natural world, basically. You mentioned that this running hypothesis, this idea that, you know, we could run down faster animals and catch up to them, capture them. But also it allows us to forage in the sun where other creatures can't do it in quite the same way. Just say something about that.
Yeah. So if you think about it, when you have, when you're bipedal and when you're naked, right, you can forage in the sun standing up, right, so that most of your body is not being hit directly by, you know, the rays of the sun. It's mostly only hitting the top of your head, which, by the way, in humans remained furry, right? So our hair does protect us, right? And, you know, that leaves so much less real estate for the sun to heat compared to, you know, something that's running around on all fours. And so it's really interesting because our sweat glands have allowed us to dominate the natural world. It's helped us, but it's been in concert with other kind of evolutionary things that are, you know, unique to humans or common among humans, like bipedalism, right? And nudity or nakedness, hairlessness, or near hairlessness. So yeah, it's this really fascinating way in which evolution kind of takes what's happening to that animal and, you know, capitalizes on it.
How did people of another time, you know, hundreds, thousands of years ago, you know, thinkers and philosophers and early physicians, how did they understand or explain sweat?
There's been some really interesting observations from various, you know, big name scientists of the past. So, you know, one, of course, is Galen, you know, the famous doctor and actually just overall scientist. And he looked at sweat and understood that, you know, it was evaporating away. But he is actually to blame for the detox myth that, you know, exists now. So, you know, the detox myth is that, you know, stuff that's inside your body that's nasty and that you don't want is coming out in sweat. And that is a myth because, you know, sweat is sourced from the watery parts of your blood. If you got rid of all the crap in your blood that way, you would, you know, have to get rid of all the liquid in your blood and you'd dehydrate and die. But Galen came to this conclusion because he actually made an intelligent observation. So he noticed that people could lose fat, that people could lose weight when they exercised a lot and, you know, when they consequently sweat a lot. And so Galen thought that quite literally sweat was a fat leaching process. He thought that, you know, when people who had fat on their bodies lost that fat through exercise, it was like coming out their sweat pores, which is, of course, you know, not the case. It's a much more complicated situation of calorie burning and, you know, other, you know, metabolic things going on. But because he thought that, and because he was such an influential thinker, that myth remains today. This idea that, you know, you're getting rid of waste through sweat, which is absolutely not the case. Whatever comes out in sweat is just incidental. It just happened to be swirling around in your blood before your sweat glands got the cool down directive, and that liquidy part of blood was dispatched to the surface to help your body cool down.
Sarah Eberts. Her new book is The Joy of Sweat, The Strange Science of Perspiration. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Listener support makes programming possible on KUER. You can easily manage your donation anytime with MyKUER. It's a place to go to update your contact information, find tax receipts, change the amount of your donation, or switch payment methods. For example, you can update that expired credit card with a direct donation from your bank account. Sign into your personal online donor profile at KUER.org/MyKUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we're talking about sweat. It's summer, so you're doing your fair share, and you know it can be embarrassing and annoying, but the science journalist Sarah Eberts explains in a new book that as biological systems go, this one is dramatic and flamboyant. So she's explaining how it works today. Her book is called The Joy of Sweat. One of the things you write about is how in Western society, we've made hiding our sweat and the odor that comes from it a matter of social acceptance. That in the North America mindset you mentioned is afraid of body odors. People think there's something wrong with you. talk a little bit about how we got that way, how we came to this kind of shame about sweating in social circumstances.
So I actually have this on my wall. It's a quote from the Roman poet Catullus to his friend and then his nemesis Rufus. And he says, "Wonder not, Rufus, why none of the opposite sex wishes to place her dainty thighs beneath you, not even if you undermine her virtue with gifts of choice silk or the enticement of a pellucid gem. You are being hurt by an ugly rumor which asserts that beneath your armpits dwells a ferocious goat. This they fear, and no wonder, for it's a right rank beast that no pretty girl will go to bed with. So either get rid of this painful affront to the nostrils, or cease to wonder why the ladies flee."
So this aversion.
This is old. Yeah. This is 2,000 years old, right? So I think, you know, we have worried about our body odor for thousands of years. But for most of human history, when we've wanted to modulate how we smell, we've either used soap and water and or applied perfume, either to overwhelm our stink or to, you know, complement our natural odors. And it's only though in the 20th century, in the early parts of that century, where things are taken to a whole nother level. And that's, you know, at the dawn of the deodorant and the antiperspirant industry. And, you know, around the turn of the 20th century, lots of entrepreneurs are, you know, coming up with products that actually actively try to interrupt the odors coming out of your armpits. But, you know, nobody actually thinks they need to use it because everyone is doing the same things that people did back in the Roman era and before. They're either washing with soap and water and or adding a little bit of perfume. And so these early entrepreneurs are not having any luck until this one high school student whose name was Edna Murphy. And she had a product out called Odor Oh No. And it had been borrowed from her dad, who's actually a surgeon in Cincinnati. And his hands sweat a lot. And he was worried about, you know, dropping knives during surgeries. So he had, you know, come up with this antiperspirant to effectively stop sweat in his hands. Well, Edna thought, hey, let's try this in armpits. And she had launched this product called Odor Oh No. Well, nobody wanted to buy it, like all of the other products around the same time, like Mum and other early entrepreneurs. So she hires a copywriter from J. Walter Thompson, which is, like, you know, a big marketing firm out of New York City. And this is the 1919s. And she ends up with this guy named James Webb, who is a, you know, former traveling Bible salesman, and kind of comes up with this unusual strategy for selling her product. And he gets this huge ad out in Ladies Home Journal. And if you look at the picture that it shows, it's this beautiful woman dancing with a man. And it leads with, you know, in the curve of a woman's arm. And it goes on to say that, you know, armpits ought to be beautiful because, you know, they're part of that beautiful curve of a woman's arm, but actually they're not. They're a smelly thing. And not only are you stinking and don't realize it, but people are gossiping behind your back about it. And adding insult to injury, you're not going to get a man. You're not going to find a husband if you don't wear Odor Oh No. So it's 1919, right? So very, very clear on, you know, what a woman ought to be after. And, you know, so many women reading Ladies Home Journal were offended that a lot of canceled their subscriptions, but many more were so, you know, impacted by this ad that sales of Odor Oh No began to skyrocket. And soon many other antiperspirant and deodorant companies are borrowing from this strategy, which is, you know, known in the marketing world as whisper copy, to sell their own products, you know, with headlines like "Beautiful but dumb," you know, "She never has learnt, you know, the trick to long lasting charm," and other things like that. And, you know, finally by the 30s, they've maxed out the market targeting women. And then they're like, we still need to make some money. maybe we should, target men. Men stink too. And so, you know, but in the 30s, it's the Depression. Men are worried about losing a job. And so the whisper copy that they use to, you know, entice men to use these products focuses on their fear of losing a job or career advancement. And so it's effectively the idea, if you don't wear deodorant or antiperspirant in the boardroom, people are going to talk about you. They're going to gossip about you, and you're not going to get that promotion or that contract that you desperately need. So, you know, we now wear it in mass. It's a $75 billion industry. But there was really a nexus point at the early 20th century because, you know, prior to that, you know, we just used soap and water and a bit of perfume. Now we use all sorts of products.
Explain, what is body odor?
Sure. So we produce two kinds of sweat. So there's the sweat that helps us cool down. That's the salty liquid water that, you know, floods our skin on a hot day. But there is another. And this is another kind of sweat gland that appears or becomes actually active at puberty in our armpits or anywhere where you grow hair at puberty. And effectively, the sweat from these glands is to blame for your body odor, but it's not really you. So that sweat is waxy. It's actually more similar to earwax. And when it emerges from the sweat glands, it's relatively odorless. It's the bacteria and other microbes in your armpit that eat that sweat and convert it into the stinky odor molecules that, you know, percolate out of your armpit and into people's noses. So, you know, it's kind of like a good news, bad news situation. You know, the good news is if you stink, it's not really you. The bad news is if you stink, it's, you know, bacteria in your armpit eating your sweat and effectively pooping out stinky odors. So I'll leave you to decide whether it's a good news, bad news situation for you. But that's to blame for most of our BO. And, you know, you have a unique body odor print and I have a unique body odor print. But in human body odor, there are kind of two top notes. These are the things that allow you to know when a stinky human has been in the elevator before you versus, you know, a stinky dog or horse. And these two molecules, one kind of smells a bit like goat, stinky goat, and the other one is more like onion meets rancid tropical fruit. And these two top notes are the things that are in most human body odor that like allow us to be like another human, for better or for worse.
You know, you mentioned in the book that really from birth, we rely on our sense of smell to learn the body odor of people that we love or that we're going to need. You mentioned that this sniffing the odor of our loved ones, that continues throughout our life, you mentioned. So I wanted to ask you about the opportunities that we take that maybe some of us don't realize to frankly sniff others, to smell others. So you mentioned hugging and cheek kissing. Those are good opportunities. And there's this great story, this great experiment involving a handshake that I want to ask you about too. But just talk about social cohesion, how the importance of odor is for some social cohesion.
Well, we learn so much with our noses, despite the fact that, you know, companies tell us that we shouldn't. So even from birth, a parent can identify the body odor of their newborn just within hours of their appearance on this planet. And, you know, siblings can identify the BO of a brother or a sister that they haven't seen in years. And we have these body odor prints that we, you know, use just to recognize one another. And, you know, there's huge nostalgia related to, you know, recognizing an odor that we like. Sometimes it's, you know, an odor of, you know, a food, but sometimes it's an odor of a person. Like think of going to a loved one's house, a grandmother or a lover. There's this familiarity and nostalgia that we have in, you know, recognizing people that we love from their body odor print.
Tell the story of the experiment involving the handshake. This research team, this team videotaped secretly videotaped people after they shook someone's hand. Say something about that, because I think this is great.
So not only does our body odor and the odors of others, you know, inspire nostalgia, but we actually sniff other people when we meet them. And so if you think most human greetings involve some proximity, yeah. either, you know, a cheek kiss, a handshake, or a bow, but when you are actually shaking somebody's hand, what scientists have recorded from individuals meeting for the first time is that, you know, after that handshake, you surreptitiously sniff your hand. And in fact, the people who were subjects in this study thought that the videos had been faked. Right?
Yeah.
And the scientists were like, we don't have that skill set. And, you know, it's interesting, though, because we are sniffing out new information. And, you know, the same researchers just actually published a study this spring where they found that besties, people who became extremely fast friends, that their body odor profiles are actually more similar than two people at random. And so, you know, we're using our noses to learn, you know, about, you know, the body odor print and perhaps helping us decide who we want to hang out with.
You mentioned the study that was done in New Mexico where the question was, would a woman in a strip club be more attractive to straight men? This was the study that they did this on straight men. Would she be more attractive to straight men during the most fertile period of her menstrual cycle?
And what's so fascinating is that the researchers found that lap dancers get higher tips yeah. when they are ovulating, when, you know, they are most fertile. And, you know, this must be unconscious because, you know, from the perspective of the lap dancer, she needs to make money and she's, you know, motivated to do that regardless of where she is in her menstrual cycle. And you'd assume that the clients are really not interested in impregnating the lap dancer. But yet, you know, yeah, the tips are highest when she's actually fertile. So, you know, there's all this really fascinating, tantalizing evidence that we are sniffing each other out and that we are learning fascinating information. The trouble has been from the chemistry point of view, where chemists have been hard at work capturing the hundreds of molecules that percolate up into the air, out of our armpits, and try and categorize, okay, which ones might be responsible for, you know, cluing others into the fact that we're anxious, or perhaps saying, hey, you know, I've got this kind of immune system. And unfortunately, the chemists haven't figured out a way to actually pluck out those, you know, chemosensory molecules, the ones giving those tips, which doesn't mean that online snake oil entrepreneurs haven't tried yeah. to sell yeah. you know, human pheromone cologne, which is like a total hoax. Yeah. What's hilarious to me is that many of these products contain boar pheromone. So they
wow.
are a pheromone, but they're not human pheromone.
Yeah.
They're the pheromone of, you know, wild pigs. And so, you know, you will attract somebody or you something, but it may not be a human female. It'll be a human boar. So no judgment there.
Okay, but you go to Russia, you go to Moscow.
Yes.
And you have this experience. And you have to talk about what it was you smelled in jar number 15. Because there was
jar number 15.
Yeah, so tell us about that.
So there are these wonderful events called smell dating events. And the premise is that at some point in any romantic interlude, whether it's for one evening or for a lifetime, you are going to smell the BO of that person, and it will be a make or break moment. So why not, you know, effectively use body odor as your triage and then see if, you know, looks and personality also match up. And so in practice, how this works is you go to one of these events, and they've happened all around the world, New York, Brazil, Rio de Janeiro, Berlin, London, but I went to one in Moscow. And you get there, and the first thing you're handed is a wet wipe. And so you wipe down anywhere that you might have used deodorant or perfume. And once you're kind of, you know, all clean, you do some calisthenics. They take you through like high intensity exercise, like burpees and jumping jacks, so that you work up a sweat.
Yeah.
And then you're given a cotton pad where you dab your parts. And that cotton pad is put into a glass jar, and the jars are numbered, and only you know your number and the organizers know your number. And they're put on a table, and then they're like, have at it. And everybody sniffs through these glass jars. And your goal is to find your top favorite five. And then one, God, I still remember the number. It was number 15, was just like an epiphany. It made me think of sex. I just was like, hello, hide and jar number 15. You are now on my list. And it wasn't that, you know, I couldn't control myself or anything like that, but it was just like such a zing moment for me. So after what happens is I put my five numbers on the list. And if, for example, I had picked you and you had picked me, then we would be a match. And it being Moscow, we would have been given a VIP bracelet to an all-you-can-drink vodka cocktail lounge so that we could, you know, find out if the optics and, you know, shared love of, I don't know, taxidermy also made us hit it off. Anyway, so I did get matched with somebody, but it wasn't number 15. I got matched with the person who reminded me of this like grassy field and kind of had this like familiar, nice body odor to me. But yeah, number 15, I had my eye out for, because what they do is they have they're like number 23 matches with number 7. And I don't think number 15 matched with anybody, because even when I found out that I didn't match with number 15, I was like scouting, because I'm like, I need to know who number 15 was. But number 15 was the one that got away.
Sarah Everts, her new book is The Joy of Sweat. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER is proud to be a listener-supported public radio station. We'd like to thank our community of more than 10,000 sustainers who make a monthly contribution to the station, starting at just $5 a month. Because of your support, all the news, stories, and conversations that you hear are independent, calm, and commercial-free. If something you heard on KUER made a difference to you recently, become a new sustainer or increase your existing pledge at KUER.org/donate.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We're talking about perspiration today, sweat. The science journalist Sarah Everts is explaining it, how it's a uniquely human feature, how it may have helped us get to the top of the food chain, how it reveals things about us, like our sex appeal. The book is called The Joy of Sweat. So where is this heading, do you think? Because you write, whether we like it or not, body odor is this really deeply honest signal. And you mention in the book, you write about the medical conditions, how nurses can recognize certain infections by smell. There's a smell to Parkinson's disease you write about. There's some researchers who think that there's a way to diagnose certain diseases like cancer through smell. And this idea that ideas of odor being revealed, you know, revealing anxiety. So you could install chemical detectors at airports somehow would respond to fear. And so where's this heading? Because you do seem to be concerned a bit about what you say are these kind of possible, you know, exploiting this, I think you put it, biological transparency, I think is how you put it.
You know, there's all these ways in which we can detect things about people through their sweat, whether it is through their odor or through, you know, the drips of sweat that we're leaving on mats if we do chemical analyses of those. And I would say that in terms of surveillance, the chemical analysis of just that watery sweat is probably most advanced, because you can use analytical equipment right now to detect, you know, your vices as well as your health in the drops of sweat that you leave even just behind in a fingerprint. And, you know, it does worry me, because you can imagine a workplace, an employer wondering whether their employees came to work intoxicated, and doing, you know, a quick analysis of their fingerprints left behind in their cubicle. Or you can imagine a health insurer trying to decide whether to give someone insurance to see if they have a pre-existing condition. Because, for example, some proteins related to cancers come out in sweat. And so there's all these kind of dystopian applications that I do worry about. Also, just, you know, if these sweat patches come to fruition, where it's an add-on to your smartwatch or your smartphone, you know, these always involve companies that, you know, acquire into the cloud information about the sweat that's pouring out of your body all the time. And so what if, you know, information about your predilections, your vices, your health is on these database servers? And what if that company, you know, sells your data because you haven't clicked the right privacy information, or, you know, gone through your privacy agreement very carefully? Or what if there's a hack? And so I really hope that privacy advocates get on this and work out safe policy before these things become mainstream, because, you know, they're in development phase, but they haven't hit, you know, the mainstream yet.
This was interesting. You asked this question in the book about whether some people just seem to be sweatier than others. Or whether it's just related to circumstance and environment. And so it seems like there's a bit of both nature and nurture going on. But you do talk about some people who are afflicted with this condition of extreme sweating. Would you talk a little bit about this? Because it sounds, I don't know, it sounds really debilitating.
Yeah, it really can be. It's a condition called hyperhidrosis, and about 15 million Americans have it. And, you know, a lot of us are, you know, embarrassed by our sweat, and sweat is stigmatized. But this is, you know, a really whole nother level of sweating and stigma, frankly. So it, you know, often people with hyperhidrosis have extreme amounts of sweat coming out of their hands, their feet, their foreheads, or their armpits. And it leads to an inability to necessarily hold on to things. You know, cell phones slip out of their hands. You know, holding a piece of paper, it gets soggy and mucky and dissolves. And so it kind of leads to, you know, embarrassing and problematic situations in the workplace, in social encounters. And, you know, there's not, you know, not any kind of foolproof method of controlling your sweat. So, you know, I really wish that there was just, you know, a whole lot less stigma about sweat. It's your body trying to cool down. And quite frankly, you know, sometimes you really can't control the sweat. In fact, you know, if you look at, you know, most other bodily functions, you can hold back, you know, a burp or, you know, even a fart for a small amount of time. But when your body gets the cool down directive, those floodgates open and there's absolutely nothing you can do. So, yeah, I just wish both that society wasn't quite so cruel, and also that medical researchers really dug in and came up with foolproof methods for hyperhidrosis. Because there are some strategies, you know, some people try Botox to kind of incapacitate their sweat glands. Some people use a technique that involves microwaving your sweat glands. Some individuals try soaking their hands and feet in a bath that has a mild electrocution going on. So, you know, there's a lot of things, but none of them work perfectly or, you know, permanently and safely. So, yeah, I really do wish the medical research in, you know, would really focus on this.
There's this incredibly strange and, I have to say, kind of scary sounding story from the 15th century in England a perspiration plague, I think is how you describe it. This sweating sickness. Do you want to say something about that?
Yeah. Of the many plagues that befell the world in the Middle Ages, this one was really alarming because it particularly hit people in the prime. You know, many pandemics hit those, you know, who are older or younger, but this one not only struck and killed people who were in the prime of their lives, but it happened very quickly. Like, people would sweat so much and then they would die within about 24 hours. And it was so alarming. It started in the 15th century, I believe, and then kind of kept coming back every couple of decades. And, you know, people would be so terrified when it would reappear that they would scatter from cities. And, you know, there was all sorts of things that were blamed. So the printing press and, you know, Martin Luther happened in one sort of spell in between sweating pandemics. And so the Catholic Church blamed that on it, you know, it is the wrath of God against the split in the church. Then there is, you know, blaming of comets, but yeah, it was called sweaty. And there was another sweating pandemic called the Picardy sweat, which some think was responsible for Mozart's death. So yeah, some fascinating pandemics in the past, you know, whose main quality was that they, you know, the person sweat a heck of a lot.
Those who studied this English sweating sickness warned that it could possibly return, which brings us to something kind of intriguing that you mentioned in the book, that this is how you put it. You say our ability to sweat may be foundational to the resilience we need to get through the coming climate apocalypse. Explain what you mean by that.
So the world is warming, right? And the fact that we are able to sweat, this helped our evolutionary forebears to, you know, travel the savannah, travel to all sorts of ecosystems of the world, and to survive and to thrive, kind of for better or for worse, as, you know, the worst being we've ultimately thrived so much that we've caused climate change. And so it's like this dark, macabre irony that this capability that allowed us to effectively or helped us dominate the natural world to the point that we're heating it up will also probably be the last resort for our survival for this coming climate apocalypse, right? The earth is getting hotter. We need to be able to survive in hotter temperatures, and our ability to sweat is our superpower. And so it seems deeply unfair that as you know, a species that does well, that can thrive in heat, that, you know, we're both responsible for global warming. And, you know, this is also going to be one of the things that helps us survive it. Deeply unfair.
Final question. You asked this question early in the book. Why don't we delight in our ability to produce sweat? In the same way we think it's so cool that a spider can produce silk. Do you think we'll ever overcome this stigma about sweat?
Well, we're going to have to if we're going to survive the climate apocalypse. But, you know, I do think that it's this anxiety about sweating, which I have too. You know, part of my motivation for writing this book was just, you know, being a bit anxious myself about the fact that I sweat a lot. The fact that, you know, when I'm doing a workout, I'm, you know, grabbing a towel during the warm-up part. And so, you know, I include myself in this kind of anxiety. And I think it's partly due to the fact that we have so little control over our sweat. You know, as I was saying before, you know, when we have to do other embarrassing things like burp or fart, you know, we can extract ourselves from a social situation and, you know, deal with it. But, you know, when our bodies start to sweat, there is nothing we can do to stop it. It's like such an honest signal in this era of curated, you know, personalities and curated images. And so I think, you know, not only is it out of our control, and humans do not like to be out of control, we like to control our image, but in this era of, you know, Insta and just constant, you know, perfect images of ourselves in on the online world, to have these breaches of our body just doing whatever the heck it wants to do, I think really does stress us out. And yeah, I think we really just have to, you know, let go and find some serenity instead of shame in all the sweating that we do.
Sarah Evarts, thank you very much.
It was my pleasure.
Sarah Evarts, she's a science journalist. Her new book is called The Joy of Sweat, The Strange Science of Perspiration. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.